25 years ago, in the year 2000, Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen launched the Experience Music Project in Seattle. While originally envisioned as a museum dedicated to Seattle's own rock god, Jimi Hendrix, the Experience Music Project broadened its scope and soon became the Museum of Pop Culture, or MOPOP. Housed in an instantly iconic building by architect Frank Gehry with more than 140,000 square feet covering three floors, visitors on any given day can explore exhibitions and installations on guitars, video games, comics, science fiction, sports, fashion, music, Kurt Cobain, and more. As MOPOP prepares to celebrate their silver anniversary, they invited us up to tour the space and have a live conversation with their CEO, Michelle Y. Smith. From Philbrick Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is the Season 9 finale of Museum Confidential.
There's lots to talk about, so we'll just kind of dive into it. One of the things I've been so thrilled about getting to spend some time here is just the breadth of topics and areas that the museum covers, and that's everything from the Princess Diana show that's opening today. I love the idea of kind of a pop-up, these really short-run things. That's very cool. But, you know, everything from video games to comic books and all the different things. So there's so many things you can dig into. The museum is celebrating its 25th anniversary this summer. How do you kind of think that pop culture as we define it has changed since the museum opened? Because it seems like it's always growing and expanding its definition.
I like to talk about pop culture that it's an essential part of everyone's identity. It defines us, and in turn, we define it. And it's the creators that disrupt the norm that advance the culture. It's ever changing. It's ever moving. We like to say that it's the power of pop culture, that it's a global language, and it's always changing. So I think for here, you'll see that we'll change out the exhibits from time to time. We focus on fashion, film, gaming, and music. So there's always something going on. And for this great example, the pop-up exhibit was an opportunity to partner with Julian's Auctions as they have this iconic collection of a time with Princess Diana collection that has never been seen before. We're the only museum that is going to see it. It's going to go on tour, and then it will then go off to auction. So providing those opportunities to see these iconic moments like the pop-ups are great things for our visitors to see. So.
If this is popular culture, how do you define unpopular culture?
I don't know if you...
Is that everything else?
I think it's up to the person who is watching pop culture. Some people say it's unpopular culture. I don't agree or disagree. You know, everyone has their own opinion. I think it just is thinking about pop culture and how it sparks you and your creativity and what makes you think about it or makes you go read a book or learn more about what has been shown or on the particular walls or in the exhibits.
One of the things that I loved getting to tour with on a day you were open and getting to see people engaging with the exhibitions and all of that is these kinds of museums offer something that I think is slightly different than your traditional quote unquote fine arts museum. And maybe more in line with some of like a natural history museum is, but I was watching people leave and everyone really was leaving like on cloud nine. They were smiling and happy. And it's because something here probably touched on something in their past or something that they love. And it brought out some kind of, you know, either a feeling or empathy or something, but it took it to some higher plane where sometimes you see a costume or an object, it can be very dead in a certain way, but it's kind of what the guests bring with them to the show that really seemed to me to be the thing that moved me about it.
I mean, I think our visitors, we want to be a museum for all. And I think that it's multi-generational. What I like to see when I see visitors is that you'll have someone from a younger generation or an older generation talking about an item that is here that they've seen and they tell their story or how it evoked an emotion. And then you have a younger generation talking about what's actually in the present or forward facing that's current in pop culture. So when families are coming, there's something for everyone to see and talk about. And I think that's really exciting where it invokes that emotion where they're really nostalgic or they're talking about something currently in the present or something in the past that they're, you know, that is brought to the forefront of education and learning and history of something that they didn't even know about while they visited here and learned.
You have a varied background in the path that led you to here. What do you think was your biggest learning curve when you took this job? Like, you know, the thing you were like, I have to kind of focus on this. And then what also was the thing that you think was the biggest asset that you brought to the job?
I think my biggest learning curve, you know, I have my collections and exhibits team here, and they gave me the opportunity to give my background to our permanent collection on prints and just understanding how to break down the didactic of explaining about what I was feeling when I put together my thoughts about how prints made me feel and why it was important to me. It's not as easy as you think it is to get it down to that format of the words. And I remember I wrote it out and I was talking to the curators and they were like, that's too many words, Michelle. You're going to have to, you know, dial that down. And I thought, you know, I have to learn about all those things. And I think I learn a lot of things every day from each employee that I'm working with. What I bring to the organization is probably the wanderlust and the innovation of being a positive disruptor and allowing my staff to be curious and to go after different things that make us different to who we are. You know, museums are not just putting artifacts in a museum or paintings on the wall, but we're really telling stories that have not been told and the narratives behind it. And I think that, you know, for me, bringing that knowledge of extraordinary experiences, telling stories, and really encouraging people to be curious as we move forward with our exhibits and how we work and how we do venue experiences and being a community ally is at the forefront from my background, as well as philanthropy.
I was listening to a podcast and they were talking about culture, and someone brought up this concept of, it was trying to get to the core of how to reach generations. If something can go past one or two generations and become something that's beloved for a long time. And they brought up this idea about certain things expiring, you know, like when I was a kid, I still watched the shows maybe that my parents watched because they were on reruns on Nick at Night or something. But those have kind of gone. That's expired now in a certain way. Do you view the mission in some ways of the museum as trying to respond to what's happening now? Or are you trying to carry on a love and passion for things from the past? I mean, it could be both, I guess, too.
I think it's a little bit of both. I think we honor the past. We take a nod to the present, and then we talk about the future. You know, what's really important for us is also honoring, understanding what the youth are talking about, staying current in current times, but also reflecting on the past and the history, not erasing history. So I think there's a lot of lessons to be learned by some of the artifacts that we have in our collection that really tell a story of history. But then there's also new artifacts that really talk about the present and what's going on in current pop culture.
I know that the museum was early on kind of an adopter of like highlighting like a hip hop exhibition. And, you know, if you go way, way, way back, the original concept of the museum was maybe going to be a Jimi Hendrix museum, you know, so obviously there's that too. But, you know, what kind of efforts have been made to kind of diversify the offerings, not just since you've been here, but, you know, in that 25 years, I would imagine there have been pivot points where they have seen some growth in terms of expanding.
Yeah. I mean, in 2000, it was the Experience Music Project. 80% of our collection, it was founded over music. And I think it's evolved into where we are today of fashion, film, gaming, and music, focusing on, you know, one of the largest hip-hop collections that we have out there, one of the largest sci-fi collections. So we've diversified our portfolio and added on to an ever-evolving big collection that we have here. Only 1% of the artifacts that you see here in the museum are here, over 80,000. So we're always changing things out and adding things in. And so it's evolved from the Experience Music Project to the Museum of Pop Culture over all of those facets of things that we talk about.
I want to touch on personal metrics for success. But before we do that, we do have to take a quick break and hear from one of our sponsors.
Okay.
So just take one moment.
Museum fatigue is real. So much to see, so little time. You need a good dose of energy to take it all in. Enter Muse Chews. With 5 times the caffeine of a single cup of black coffee and a few ingredients only recently legalized, Muse Chews will make sure you see every painting, sculpture, lithograph, installation, and antiquity without feeling spent and wrung out. Muse Chews, high impact, low dose, all good. Put a pep in your step as you amble through the Met. Muse Chews is available in pomegranate, salted caramel, blue cotton candy, and chocolate hazelnut.
So, I know, it's so dumb. It's okay. That's the point. It's okay. It's meant to be stupid. When you do an exhibition or any project here, there are certain things. We look at attendance and we look at revenue, and those are kind of the metrics oftentimes we use to do that. What do you kind of view as your personal metric for whether something is good or successful and worth pursuing?
I mean, that's a hard question to say because I think all of our exhibits are fabulous with my exhibits team here. But, you know, we look at several things. We look at, you know, how many people are coming to the museum. We look at the feedback that people give to us about the exhibit. We look at, you know, there's several different factors, the revenue that you're making, how the operation went. You know, when we open up an exhibit, we have an opening party that really kind of sets the pace. And we're just really looking to see what people and visitors are saying about the exhibit and feedback. You know, for me, it's feedback. We're always looking at feedback. We're doing surveys with our members to understand what type of program they want. So for me, a successful exhibit really is hitting all of those things. It's not just one thing at one time when you're measuring it.
So 25 years in, you're going to be celebrating this, what I guess is the silver anniversary. Is that what that is?
Yep.
And, you know, how do you go about thinking about the next 25? You know, are there strategic plans you're putting in place? You know, what is the bigger picture we're looking at? You know, how far out are you planning?
So, I mean, we plan our exhibits 3 years out, but we have a strategic and operational plan that we stood up last year in 2024, and that goes to the end of 2026. And that really is a window into the work that we are doing. So that really gives you the vision of where we're going. We made it 3 years because in the pandemic, in former roles, we had 5-year plans. And what we found is that most organizations were redoing that plan because of what was happening in our global environment, and that we realized that 5 years is too long. So we have a 3-year plan that really kind of sets the stage, knowing I like to talk about the crawl, the walk, the run. And as we move into 2026 and we end the plan, it's continuing the work and probably repeating that plan of what we want to do. We want to be a community ally. We want to serve, you know, who we are here in Seattle. We want to put extraordinary exhibits in. We want to remain financially solvent in a time that, you know, right now is a little bit scary for people. So we will repeat the strategic and operational plan because we're just, it takes 3 years to get it in and start to get to that North Star. But it really makes up the DNA of who we are and where we're going. And if you have a chance to read it, it really gives you the window into who we are and how we're looking forward. But it's going to have to be repeated and move forward and repeated again to really get to those outcomes. You really can't get to those outcomes in 3 years. You have to put that plan in place, repeat it, and then continue to move it forward.
So this is a very odd building, right? For anybody who's listening that's never been here, it's, you know, it's created by the, you know, very legendary architect Frank Gehry, but he's done a few museums. They're all interesting in the sense of, like, maybe storage wasn't at the forefront of his mind when he was doing it.
Maybe walls were.
Yes, yeah, I mean, just like some things, you know, hey, he's a genius. We get it. But, you know, 25 years in, of course, I would imagine yearly that the challenges of the space present themselves. What is the limitations of having such a specifically architectural space?
I think the limitations, and I think the team was laughing because of the space of the walls. I think that working around the accessibility of getting our exhibits here, elevators are key to how we operate, of, you know, making sure that we can get things in the building. especially of different sizes, just the maintenance of this building, the paint on the outside. We most recently just went through a renovation with our cafe, and we'll be releasing the lounge coming up at the end of this month. So maintaining this building is a large part of our operating budget and how we move forward. So there are lots of things that, if you think about it, we're in the Sound and Vision Theater. We have one of the largest LED screens, but it's aging. So there's a lot of things that we need to keep up with. You know, in the world of technology, you know, we need to keep up with the current technology that's out there. We were just talking today about AI and how that plays into different things. So lots of things to think about as we, you know, continue to move forward into the future. When you think about digital transformation, it's always changing. So we really want to keep up on that technology, cybersecurity, all those things that are happening around in our global environment. So lots to think about as we move forward and the maintaining of this one building.
So I've been to museums that have bees and make their own honey on their grounds. I've been to ones that have gardens on the roof, all kinds of different things where they make proprietary materials. But I've never been to one that's making their own scent before. And you were telling me about this project. Tell us about this perfume, cologne, whatever we're kind of calling it.
Sure. We work with a agency called Scout Lab, and they have a client of theirs called Osmos AI that makes perfume through AI-generated an application. And they came to me and they said, Michelle, would you ever want the museum to have their own scent? And if you think about it, if you travel from Marriott, one of their biggest things right now is that they have this lifestyle scent, especially in one of their brands called The Addition, that people are like, what is this scent? It smells so good. And, you know, how does that evoke and make you feel? And they ended up starting to sell it online. You know, it became very part of their lifestyle brand that people are like, I want to buy the candle. It's in their spa. And so when the opportunity presented to be one of the first museums coming up to use art to put into the AI-generated machine and talk about a scent that would work for the museum, one of the things that we worked with was that we have this sculpture upstairs on the second floor that has 700 guitars. And I thought about it, you know, with Paul, who loved to play the guitar, with Jimi Hendrix, who, you know, was inspiring of the museum, we put the sculpture into the AI-generated machine. And I said I wanted it to be a unisex scent that would make people understand the essence of the museum through the electric guitar. And it comes out with a formula for a perfume. Now, if you think about it, because I was actually just on the phone just before we came into this session, it usually takes a year to perfect a scent. So what Osmos AI is doing is that it is taking an art, putting it into the machine learning and coming out with a fragrance with all of the information in there. And it came out with this scent. From there, I named it Electric Guitar. And so coming out soon in June for our anniversary, we will have our own scent called the Electric Guitar that can be purchased in our retail. So we've only started and we partnered with our retail provider, SSA, with 60 bottles. But we wanted to see how this is going to trend with our visitors. And we wanted to be the first museum that has taken art and put it into a AI-generated machine and coming out with its own perfume. So more to come, and I'll let you know.
What does it smell like?
You know, it has a little bit of amber scents in it. It's a scent that is for unisex, so something for everyone.
It's like a CK1 kind of thing?
Kind of like a CK1, but I mean, you know, it was funny when we first did it, we had several different ways. They put in Skittles and it came out.
Skittles.
It came out smelling too much like Skittles. Then there was something that they put in that was a little bit too flowery because I put in jasmine and I was like, oh, not everybody wants to smell like a flower. Then they put in something like spicy jalapeno, and it was a little bit, it didn't really smell that great. So we put in like amber scents, and we put in something, we said unisex amber scents, something that's really going to be male and female, and it came out with this scent. So it's hard for me to say, but I know there's hints of amber in there. There's no jasmine, there's no flowers.
No Skittles.
And no Skittles. Yeah.
Well, I can't wait to see that. I want to touch on, you mentioned Paul Allen, the founder of this, and I want to touch on his kind of legacy and also some of the challenges of kind of carrying on a founder's vision. But unfortunately, folks, we do have to keep paying these bills. And you know, we're a public radio show. And so if you'll just bear with us for a moment, we need to hear one more time from our sponsors.
This episode of Museum Confidential is sponsored by facsimiles, not a fake, not a Fugazi, not a Xerox, a facsimile. Sometimes a document or work of art on paper is just too rare, too fragile, too precious to display in public. Why? Frankly, we don't trust you. Only kidding, we trust you. It's everyone else we're worried about. Nothing personal, mind you, but when situations like this arise, we turn to facsimiles. It looks just like the real deal, but we won't get acid reflux thinking about how it could be damaged, faded by the sun, stolen, or anything like that. Marvin Gaye and Tammy Terrell had a big hit way back when with Ain't Nothing Like the Real Thing, but obviously they didn't know about facsimiles.
Paul Allen, you know, one of the founding people of Microsoft, you know, started this. He was obviously very much interested in the music side of things. You mentioned guitar, all these things, and was really the kind of the head of this vision, but, you know, passed away years back. What responsibility do you feel to kind of carry on his vision or blaze a new trail in different directions? You know, because, you know, you can't ever know as the museum goes forward, you know, exactly what his opinions would be on certain things. You know, what kind of, how much is that factored into decision making here?
When I was interviewing for the role, you know, I had a chance to talk to the board of the directors, and Jody Allen is on the board of directors and was very much part of the museum, just as well as Paul. And really, for her, the goal for me was to come in and to make it my own and take it into the 21st century, focusing on some of the core pillars of, you know, being a beacon of the community and serving in that way. And I think that they're very happy about that, but also being an innovator and a positive disruptor. You know, if you think about it, when Paul was first, you know, starting the museum, he was one of the first collectors of the hip hop flyers and genre in our collection. And fast forward in 2023, it's the 50th anniversary of hip hop. And so just always forward thinking, being an innovator and, you know, really coming out of the box and doing those different things. So I think that we are still honoring a lot of the foundational things that Paul put into place by being an innovator and a pioneer and thinking about those things, about being a community ally and really, you know, being a beacon for pop culture. So I would say that we are still doing those things, but we're doing it in the current time versus what has been happening in the past.
So you mentioned that you have had the opportunity to do a little display of this Prince material. Prince Rogers Nelson, and there's a old quote from like that movie High Fidelity where he said, you know, it's not what you're like, it's what you like that defines you, you know, the pop cultural elements, you know, what music you listen to, the films you see, the books you read. I'm curious, you know, what do you like? You know, what's the, you know, four or five, you know, your music and, you know, what kind of stuff gets you excited to?
Well, I'm a classically trained pianist and a Suzuki violinist. And I played with the Philadelphia Youth Orchestra. So I'm born and raised in Philadelphia, so pop culture has always been in my DNA. I've been brought up in the 1970s when hip-hop was prevalent. And being raised in Philadelphia, you know, I love hip-hop. I love R&B. Motown is in there. I also love a lot of dance music and EDM. So all those types of things. I like to go to Ibiza a lot and go to all of those different EDM shows, just because I love music and I love dancing. It's just part of who I am. My mom was one of the first black ballerinas of Philadelphia, and then she went on to a different career. So exposing myself to different genres, I like them all, honestly. being classically trained helps you play anything. I can read and write music myself, but I just appreciate the art form. And I love live music, and that's why it's so special to be in Seattle, because on any night of the week, you can walk up the streets of Seattle and go see a show in any different format. And I think that's what really drew me to Seattle, is being able to do that. It reminds me a little bit about Philadelphia, where there's a venue every night that you could go over here and see, you know, an EDM show, but then you could also go see, you know, the ballet around the corner, or go to a live country show or a rock show, or, you know, go to an R&B show. So I think for me, I love every genre, but one of my favorites is always going to be hip hop. It's just been a part of who I am and where I started out from Philadelphia.
Well, I'm really kind of getting a picture now. You know, you're in Ibiza, you're listening to EDM music, you're feeding like Skittles flavoring and amber stuff into the AI to make a scent. I'm like, this is creating a good kind of mental image of kind of what you're like. So I like that.
You're making me look a little wild.
I mean, that's why they asked me here. They wanted to kind of get the wild side out. I want to talk about what's going to be happening for the 25th anniversary. There's a lot of things going on to celebrate this. June is when the actual 25th anniversary officially happens. But what kind of things are people going to be expecting in this celebration?
Well, right now we have an iconic Glassy Baby. So if you're a Seattleite and you know Glassy Baby, we've made a one-of-a-kind Glassy Baby fundraiser that is on our site right now, where you can purchase this iconic candle. But on the 21st, there's going to be tons of programming out that will be on the website that you can see. We'll be celebrating the birthday. There will be all different types of programming for youth and adults. Our cafe and lounge will be open, so there will be a lot of different bites. You'll be hearing from all different people that have actually grown up within the museum, community players here. So something for everybody to, you know, come see, give a toast to the past and celebrate the present as we move on to the future, celebrating a quarter century of pop culture.
If you can just get your mind together, then come on across to me. We'll hold hands and then we'll watch the sunrise.
In the book Cultural Theory and Popular Culture, British scholar John Story provides six definitions for the term. 1. Popular culture is simply culture that is widely favored or well-liked by many people. It has no negative connotations. 2. Popular culture is whatever is left after you've identified what, quote, high culture is. In this definition, pop culture is considered inferior, and it functions as a marker of status and class. 3. Pop culture can be defined as commercial objects that are produced for mass consumption by non-discriminating consumers. In this definition, popular culture is a tool used by the elites to suppress or take advantage of the masses. 4. Popular culture is folk culture, something that arises from the people rather than imposed upon them. Pop culture is authentic, created by the people, as opposed to commercial, thrust upon them by commercial enterprises. 5. Pop culture is negotiated, partly imposed on by the dominant classes and partly resisted or changed by the subordinate classes. Dominants can create culture, but the subordinates decide what they keep or discard. And 6. The last definition of pop culture discussed by Story is that in the postmodern world, in today's world, the distinction between authentic versus commercial is blurred. In pop culture today, users are free to embrace some manufactured content, alter it for their own use, or reject it entirely and create their own.
Goodbye. Let our hearts call it a day. But before you walk away, I sincerely want to
say, I wish you bluebirds.
Well, that's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory in the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about the station or the museum, visit publicradiotulsa.org or philbrook.org or both. As always, we suggest both. Until next time, look closer.
To cool you in some leafy glade, I wish you health and more than wealth. I wish you love, my breaking heart.